hey there. I'm Margaret Wappler, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. It is down to only I, Margaret Wappler, of the original cast and crew of Pop Rocket. There's no Karen, there's no Guy, and there's no Winter, but we have a fine assembly of guests today to talk to me about film, TV, music, or anything else entertaining. We have media scholar and TV critic Sarah Kessler back for her second Jeopardy week in a row.
Indeed. With less than a whole week separating my two sessions with you all. Believe me, I'm just as surprised as anyone else. But yes, Karen has some kind of lung ailment, and I forced her to stay in bed, which, as you may all realize just from listening to her regularly, is very difficult to do. So she is under strict orders to stay in bed, watch Mrs. Maisel, and drink soup all day.
Well, Karen, we're thinking about you. Hope you get better soon. Carolina Miranda is our next guest. Carolina, how should we describe you?
How should you describe me? Art and architecture writer for the Los Angeles Times.
Bon vivant. Do you feel comfortable?
Well, these days I don't feel very bon vivant-ish, but
I
allude to, I aspire to it. Burrito eater, narco novella watcher, and you know, attempting to finish reading the books I start.
Well, you have like two more weeks of 2018, right? And then the clock just starts anew.
Exactly. All the 500-page books I've started in the last couple of weeks, I'll have to get them all done between Christmas and New Year's.
You got time. I believe in you.
Okay, thank you.
And last but not least, we have David Earle here. Listeners might be more familiar with him from his role as father to Silas Earle and husband of yours truly.
That's right. It's been an off-mic role. Until now.
That's right. Yeah. People have just had to wonder. So, David, tell us about yourself.
I am an artist and educator. I teach at the Armory Center for the Arts in Pasadena and CalArts up in Valencia. And I teach a class on radio, actually, called Art of the Invisible.
By the way, tonight, you know that you're the official spokesman for all straight men. Because we barely ever have a straight man on. So when we get one, you have to speak for all.
Well, spokesman means that I actually have to
somehow sell
the idea of being straight. Is that right? Like I have to convince people.
Yeah.
Because that's not my bag.
Right.
That's not what I'm here for.
Okay.
It's nice. It's great, you know, but we all make our own lives.
All right, you guys. Coming up in this week's show, we'll discuss depictions of visual artists in film and TV. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about what we're all about this week. So, Sarah, what are you about?
Okay, so I've been on this like feminist literature kick recently, kind of going back and revisiting some of the greats. And so I am all about, and I think this is very appropriate to today's session, Valerie Solanas's Scum Manifesto, the 2013 AK Press edition with a foreword by Michelle T.
Nice.
And so for those who are unfamiliar, SCUM is an acronym for the Society for Cutting Up Men. I hope everyone already knew that, but if you didn't, maybe you can, you know.
It might shock you a little bit.
Get flared up hearing that. And basically, it's sort of what it sounds like. It's a radical feminist rant that was drafted in 1967. And then the following year, Solanas actually did go on to shoot Andy Warhol. She had been featured in a couple of his films, and she had unsuccessfully tried to get him to produce a play of hers entitled Up Your Ass, and he would not produce it, and so she shot him. There's, of course, a lot more to it than that. But when she confessed to the shooting, she said, he had too much control over my life. Like,
wow.
And Warhol had too much control over my life.
I think a lot of people in the art world feel that way.
Yes. And I, you know, anyway, there's so much to say about
by
that.
By rejection, he had so much control.
Yes, through the act of rejection.
Yeah.
But the manifesto itself is this kind of indictment of capitalist patriarchy, and it has this very, like, conspiracy theory vibe to it when you're reading it. Michelle T does this really amazing job of introducing the text and kind of contextualizing it. And she frames Solanas' writing, which is really often dismissed as these kind of lunatic ravings as a testament to how much sense it makes to feel crazy under patriarchy.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that's basically the continuing fascination that feminists in particular have with Valerie Solanas? Like, she's a certifiably crazy person, but yet there is some kind of truth to her madness, right?
Yeah. I mean, reading the manifesto, like I'll just, if you don't mind, I'll read a very like short little passage. The veneration of art and culture, besides leading many women into boring passive activity that distracts from more important and rewarding activities and from cultivating active abilities, and leads to the constant intrusion on our sensibilities of pompous dissertations on the deep beauty of this and that turd. This allows the artist, in quotes, to be set up as one possessing superior feelings, perceptions, insights, and judgments, thereby undermining the faith of insecure women in the value and validity of their own feelings, perceptions, insights, and judgments. And, you know, I mean, it's like, I mean, she says
not wrong.
It's solid.
Right, yeah. There's a lot of solidity there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Carolina, what are you about?
I've been on a self-imposed narco-novella bender for approximately 2 years.
Long
Well, it's like novellas, you know, have 70 chapters, and I'm a completist, and I have to watch every one.
Wow.
So I've been on this bender, and so I've gotten into Narcos Mexico, which is not technically a narco novella because I think of the novellas as coming from Latin America. Mm. But I think, you know, it's been interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One is Diego Luna is playing Felix Gallardo, the 80s cartel leader, and he's just amazing to watch. You know, he's an actor who can go from being like kind of cute and friendly and youthful to just being this terrifying monster. And to see him play this, you know, I haven't seen the entire series yet, but he starts off as this kind of like likable bandit cop who goes building this empire and really has the foresight to say, hey, you know, rather than operating independently, the cartels could get together and as a result command more money for weed. This is when the big market was in marijuana and not yet in cocaine. And then opposite him as the DEA agent is Anthony Pena as Quique Camarena, who was that DEA agent that was famously killed. And so it's interesting to me for a couple of reasons. The performances are really interesting. It's a period of narco history that is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. But it's also I felt like the first Narcos season about Pablo Escobar so blew it by hiring a Brazilian actor who didn't know how to speak Spanish in the role of Escobar. Like, they took the time to set the show. Go figure.
Yeah.
Well, the director had worked with him before, but it was this thing of they took the trouble to set the show in Colombia. There was a lot of shooting in Medellin. And they took the trouble to hire a lot of Colombian actors. So you had this kind of like film of this veneer of authenticity. But then for the main role. Mm.
Right.
They hire a Brazilian guy who didn't know how to speak Spanish. And most of the show is in English because it's all told from the point of view from the DEA agent. But for me, it just made it incredibly distracting because I do speak Spanish. And so
every time he spoke in Spanish, it was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, and he played
Pablo. Like he has a Portuguese kind of accent.
Yeah,
on
and you
it.
Could tell he was almost doing these literal readings of Spanish rather than really feeling the language. And Colombian Spanish, it's like so
fast.
It's fast. It's really lyrical. It's full of this like amazing slang. And so to hear someone kind of butcher that just completely took me out of the series. So to see Narcos Mexico in which you have a Mexican actor and a Mexican-American actor, and everyone is kind of doing their thing, and they're doing it really well. Like, I'm just, I forgive Narcos season one.
Okay, so it's recovered.
So, yeah, exactly.
David, what are you all about, sir?
So my all about is a ambivalent all about, I have to say, or maybe it's just a love-hate. But it's December, and so the Spotify just produced my top songs for 2018.
And really, we should say your songs, some of my songs, and then at least two of Silas's songs.
Actually, far too many songs that we play to keep Silas from calm. Breaking down.
Yeah.
So Spotify takes everything that we've played and finds the ones that are most often played and then just drops them in a playlist, which is one handy place to just like review and enjoy the entire year and remember, oh, that song from April, that was amazing. And it's great. I love it when it comes out. It's so exciting. But then I have to stop and think, like, if it were this time of year back in the day, what I would be doing is, like, combing through Pitchfork review, like, year in review,
yeah,
critics lists of all, like, the best music that came out. And I'd be, like, stockpiling my wish list and, you know, like, really, it was all about new music.
Yeah.
And now I have this sort of algorithmically generated version of myself.
Right.
And that's what I'm listening to. Like, that's, it's just...
It's just mirroring back to you, yourself.
It's
here
just Spotify's yeah, version of me, and I'm really into it. So then it's like the snake just eats its tail.
It's true. Mm. Like, you don't get to make discoveries so much doing it that way.
No.
I mean, it's interesting. And it's also, like, only interesting for the moment when you see, oh, what did I actually listen to the most? What's on the top 20 or whatever?
Well,
it's... But that's fleeting, I feel like.
No, it's great. It's actually, it is a very, it's like a, it's adrenaline. It is like when I listen in the car driving to, like, you know, driving to work, like... And I'm not actually looking at the playlist. The songs just come up. It's like there's this DJ of my past year,
mm-hmm,
just like playing these songs that I love, you know, and it's just so great to hear them. And then it just, it's sort of like, well, I am in the matrix. I sort of feel like this
right,
is it, like.
You've swallowed, yeah, all of the pills.
I've swallowed both. Both pills. I know everything. And I also still believe that it's real.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will tell you guys about my All About, and David, you can chime in because we saw this together from my birthday yesterday, and that was The Favorite.
Mm-hmm.
This is the new film from director Yorgos Lanthimos, who a lot of you guys, the listeners and the people in this booth, will recognize from The Lobster, which was a very darkly hilarious take on finding love. He returns with this absurdist feminist reimagining of Queen Anne's royal court of the early 18th century England. And it's basically this power slash love triangle between Olivia Colman playing the queen, Rachel Weisz playing Sarah, who's basically her right hand person, and then Emma Stone playing Abigail, who is Rachel's cousin, or rather Sarah's cousin. And that really doesn't matter, though, because they don't know each other. They're basically like estranged. And in walks in Abigail, literally covered in manure, wanting to regain her aristocratic placement that her father gambled away. So basically, like, Sarah takes pity on her and says, fine, you can be a scullery maid. And Emma Stone makes the most of that scullery maid position and soon, like, calculates her way up the chain to also become very close to the queen. It's just, like, a very delicious, super queer sensibility movie. When I say queer, I'm not just talking about, like, a certain kind of, you know, sexual relationship that goes on, although that's there too. I'm thinking more about, like, the humor. It's so campy. It's like everything is saturated in this absurdist, like, rich, playful, naughty, tongue-in-cheek sensibility. And I just loved it. It was highly entertaining. I really ate it up. It also just, it's sly. It's very sly, mm-hmm, in this way where the kind of feminist reimaginings are basically that you see the worst of all of these women. Emma Stone's character is ruthless. Rachel Weisz's character is arrogant. Olivia Colman, who does an amazing job. I mean, we've seen her in other things, but I think this is the movie that's really going to show people that she has complete depth and range that needs to be taken advantage of. She plays this version of the queen that is, like, depressed and whiny and likes to scream at people when she just gets, like, sick of hearing them singing a song or whatever. And she's just such a baby, and yet you feel for her so much at the same time. So it's a real hat trick what he pulls off, mm-hmm, this kind of showing people at their worst, showing these women at their worst, and then showing them at their best, and making you always kind of root for all of them. I highly recommend it. You guys have to go see it. Also, the costumes from Sandy Powell, so good. Like, Rachel Weisz's costume alone, she is always dressed as this sort of, like, swashbuckling pirate lady.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. You're listening to Pop Rocket. When we come back, it's going to get super disturbed and genius-y.
Since the dawn of time, screenwriters have taken months to craft their stories. But now, three Hollywood professionals shall attempt the impossible. Break a story in 1 hour.
That's right. Here on Storybreak, I, Freddie Wong,
Matt Arnold,
and Will Campos,
the creators behind award-winning shows like Video Game High School,
have 1 hour to turn a humble idea into an awesome movie.
Now, an awesome movie starts with an awesome title.
I chose The Billionaire's Marriage Valley.
Mine was Christmas Pregnant Paradise.
Okay, next we need a protagonist.
So I've heard Wario best described as Libertarian Mario.
And of course, every great movie needs a stellar pitch.
In order to get to heaven, sometimes you gotta raise a little hell.
That's the tagline!
Check out Storybreak every week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Subscribe to the new podcast, Hello Gorgeous, the films of Barbra Streisand. In 1968, a movie star was born when Barbra Streisand made her film debut with the Oscar-winning performance in Funny Girl. To celebrate 50 years of Babs on the big screen, host Jamie Pierce is reviewing the complete Streisand filmography with the help of some fabulous folk, including Rachel Schuchert, Drew Droge, Frank DiCaro, Allison Lane, Mitch Silpa, Jack Plotnick, and more. Subscribe to get the entire series with new episodes every week, because people who need podcasts are the luckiest people alive. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler. With me in the studio are
Carolina Miranda,
David Earle,
Sarah Kessler.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
David Bowie, Crispin Glover, and Jared Harris are just a few of the performers who have memorably played Andy Warhol in the movies. He's not the only artist, though, whose life and art has been depicted on the big and small screens. Van Gogh, Frida, and Picasso have all been rendered in ways beautiful and moving, or trite and corny, let's be honest. In fact, the latest takes include Willem Dafoe playing Van Gogh in Julian Schnabel's At Eternity's Gate, and Antonio Banderas plays Picasso in the second season of Genius, which just earned him a Golden Globe nod. Today, we're going to look at several portrayals and ask ourselves, what does Hollywood get right about these and what do they get wrong? So you guys, I want to know, what are the films or actors that have really moved you or entertained you when it comes to portraying visual artists on the screen?
I love this topic so much and have been thinking about it for a really long time. And then the first thing that came to my mind was the film High Art, which is not actually a portrayal of a real art, quote unquote, real artist per se. I don't know why I keep saying quote unquote. God help me.
It's like once you start saying it,
just
you can't
envision
stop.
Air quotes around everything I say from now on, pretty much.
Can do.
But High Art, right, starring, of course, the incredible Ally Sheedy as an artist named Lucy Berliner. And Radha Mitchell in one of her her breakout role, I guess we could say, as a young woman named Sid who works at an art magazine. And the real resemblance to a real life art personage in the film is not Lucy Berliner herself, but actually her photographs, which are kind of curated to resemble Nan Golden's oeuvre. And I've been waiting to say oeuvre all night.
Yeah, thank you.
And to pronounce it terribly.
If we're going to talk about artistes, right. For God's sakes.
Exactly. So one of the things that I love about this film is that it is one of the 15 greatest lesbian films of all time, according to a listicle that I found today when I was researching it. I don't know where the listicle was, but I know that it's correct. I love it because it is a lesbian film. It is very, melodramatic. It's very overwrought, but in a kind of like wonderful, slashy sort of way. Radha Mitchell, Sid, moves into the apartment. I can't remember whether it's above or below Lucy Berliner's apartment. And she's has this sort of normie life with her like attractive young husband. And but she's into art, right? She works at this art magazine and she's completely seduced by the dark, heroin addicted life of this, Nan Golden-esque figure who lives in her same building, who has a girlfriend played by Patricia Clarkson, who is this kind of chain smoking, you know, junkie, basically. And, you know, just this life is really dramatic and really exciting. And so this young woman gets drawn into it. She discovers lesbianism at the same time as she kind of discovers this art. And it's like the relationship between lesbianism and art is sort of inextricable for her. She, of course, gets into a relationship with the artist and, you know, various shenanigans ensue.
Yeah. I think one of the pleasures of that movie is just seeing Ally Sheedy do all that. Do you
Absolutely.
Know what I mean? Like, she kind of came out of nowhere again. Like, mm-hmm. she did The Breakfast Club,
yes.
you know, shook the dandruff onto yeah. the book
yes.
and all of
oh,
that.
Yes.
And then just seemed to, like, submerge back into the dark sea of, like, lost
yes.
actresses and then just reemerges in that movie. And it was, I mean, it was a beautiful portrayal of, like, a really kind of fraught relationship. And I think actually
yes.
taking somebody like Nan Goldin's work is good in a film like that. Like,
yeah.
like the subtleties and just the raw imagery in her work works for film. Like, it's just a
yeah.
good...
It, yeah, it does.
And sometimes these artists that
yes.
we see, their work gets sort of lost and not translated in the film very well.
Photography can work on film in a certain way, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, that painting can't quite translate to film.
Yeah.
I think maybe might be one of the things that we come to discover. But it does. I do think that it works really well and kind of the way that the photographs are used in the film itself as you kind of see the arc of the rejuvenation of this artist's career by her new young muse, you know.
Which is also another theme that we see in a lot
yes.
of these artists' biopics and just fictional takes of, like, the power relationships that can develop between the established artist and the younger assistant.
The protege.
Younger, yeah, the
yeah.
protege, the mentee. What about for you, Carolina?
God, I'm torn, you know, because I cover art, so I sometimes have a really hard time watching movies about artists
yeah, well,
sometimes.
I think both you and David can speak to this of, like, being inside the art world on some level or another gives you a different take on watching these
yeah,
movies.
Yeah, and it's like these movies are driven by so many tropes, you know,
yeah.
the lone genius, the sort of touched artist,
mm-hmm.
you know, who mm-hmm. maybe has issues with mental health or alcohol or drugs, the tragic figure. It's almost like nobody can really just make art
right.
in film.
Yeah.
And I understand why that's not cinematic. But sometimes as somebody who writes about art and hangs out with artists, it can be a little hard to watch. What's funny is this weekend I went back and watched Julian Schnabel's Basquiat, which mm-hmm. is not that great of a movie. It has its moments, but it's not. But I think Jeffrey Wright just gives this really.
Jeffrey Wright hangs it together.
He like that entire film is essentially rests on his shoulders, and he hasn't been given much to work with script wise. The film completely overlooks, I think, aspects of his work, of Basquiat's work. You know, they kind of he gets painted as this kind of like graffiti homeless kid who, like, made it big, which is a great, like, story arc to have. But Basquiat was this deeply critical artist who, you know, touched on themes of, like, police violence mm-hmm. and, you know, the state and slavery and black mm-hmm. identity and blackness. And it completely gets erased from the film. But I think right in his gestures, in the faces he makes, mm-hmm. in, mm-hmm. like, the affect I think he's able to portray is able to humanize this character who is written a little bit as a cartoon. So I think it's quite a remarkable performance.
Yeah, I think one of the nice aspects of Basquiat is actually the friendship that blossoms between him and Andy Warhol. Like, that to me is one of the warmer aspects of that movie.
And Benicio del Toro. I mean, any scene with Benicio del Toro. That's me just because I'm a Benicio fangirl.
Yeah.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's all, like, skinny and lithe
skinny
at that
and
point.
Hot.
He really
yeah.
was.
I was like, oh, Benicio.
David, how about for you?
Well,
what's moved you as
I
far
actually
as
was,
good portrayals?
I took a cue from Carolina's list, because you had Mr. Turner on it.
Yes.
And
he is so good.
Right. I hadn't seen that. And
Mr.
You know,
Turner, just to set it up,
right,
is
so that's
Mike
Lee's
movie.
Who, it's one of the reasons I really love this movie. Mike Lee is a British film director who actually started in theater, and then he made a lot of films that were low budget, talky, kind of British pre-mumblecore, and very, very smart, well-spoken people saying sometimes heartbreaking and some always interesting things. And then he started to do period dramas, including Gilbert and Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And the thing that makes Mr. Turner work so well, so it's a portrayal of J.M.W. Turner, the British Romantic era painter. Some call him the greatest British painter. I think we might talk about it more too, like just when you have a bad art film and there's such a temptation. Art movies so often have to be about intensity and strum and drang and like the, you know, throwing a canvas across the room and spraying paint everywhere because you're a genius. And
it's required to spray paint.
Well, it's like art is somehow art making is a spectacle.
Yeah.
And this is exactly the opposite. It is filled with so many quiet moments and so much of an interest in the minutia of art making.
Do you send the cobalt blue?
Put it in a jar. Chrome yellow, scarlet late, lead white.
Canvases?
You put them downstairs for me. 2 6x4s, 3 4x3s.
McGill?
Next week.
It's very process and tactile and just... that's what draws me into the artist's world. And then I have a kind of deep... And it was... I mean, it's extremely moving, too.
Mm-hmm. I think, for me, that film was so... That's my definitely my favorite artist film of all time, because I think as a whole package together, it just holds so well. What's interesting to me about that one is that so many art films, films about artists, are based on this kind of aha moment that the artist is sitting in the studio one day, Jackson Pollock drips some paint on his barn floor, and then he paints, you know, like his first drip painting, and it's a genius masterpiece all at once. And I think what Mr. Turner was so good at showing is that art is work, and that artists are good at what they do because they work at it, and they're relentless. And, you know, Basquiat, even though he died young, was like just super prolific, and that's why Mr. Turner, I think of all of the artist movies I've seen, is the most remarkable at, I think, depicting the true artist's life.
Yeah,
because I do feel like the Vincent van Goghs and the Basquiat storylines, the Frida Kahlo storylines, that they are these very exceptional storylines, and in many ways those films aren't even about art. They're about these tragic lives.
Yes.
You know, that they could have been novelists. They could have been scientists. The movie would still kind of hinge on this.
That's true. The broken love affairs and the accidents and whatever else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And all the, like, you know, and somehow the kind of, like, moment of inspiration excusing all the dramatic fucked up behavior.
Yeah, well, you're providing a perfect, like, seg for me to talk about a movie that was sort of darkly instructive to me about artists, and that's Martin Scorsese's Life Lessons, which is part of the New York Stories trilogy. I don't know if you guys ever saw this, but it's from 1989, and it's basically three, like, sort of short films put together. One's by Coppola, one's by Woody Allen, and one's by Martin Scorsese. And Martin Scorsese's is the best one. Martin Scorsese's Life Lessons is Nick Nolte playing an older painter, an abstract expressionist, who is involved in a relationship with his young assistant, Rosanna Arquette. And she's also a painter, but obviously not nearly as famous or credentialed as he is. And he lords that power over her. And then she also kind of plays with him sexually, making him jealous, bringing home other people, that kind of thing. And, you know, David and I were watching scenes from the movie to refresh our memories, and there's this moment where she comes in while he's painting. And by the way, Scorsese, being Scorsese, like, uses a song constantly in this movie to, like, create a mood and an atmosphere, and it's Whiter Shade of Pale. So you hear, like, Whiter Shade of Pale, like, booming, and Nick Nolte, who is very handsome in the movie, I can't deny it, but he's like standing in front of this grand canvas and he's starting to, you know, slash paint all over it. And Rosanna Arquette comes in and she's like, Lionel, she's screaming his name, Lionel, and he doesn't hear her. And she kind of gives this look, she rolls her eyes, she's just like, ugh, you know. And then she turns back around to look at the canvas and she's just taken with his genius. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh my God, look at what a beautiful artwork he's creating right right now, right here in front of me. Oh, I'm in the joy and thrall and spectacle of genius. You know, what more do I need? I don't need emotional sustenance or like a healthy relationship. Fuck all that. I've got this genius painter in my life. And I remember watching that in high school, like young high school girl, and kind of feeling like, oh, that is something. That's something that's familiar to me already, like in dealing with relationships and like creative guys who like bloat themselves up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that you're supposed to tolerate anything because they're geniuses.
Yeah, you're supposed to take like kind of all their shit because they're a genius or they could be a genius. And that movie like really plays into that myth.
Or they could be. Right, or they exactly. could be a genius being the operative.
Exactly. Like nobody's actually said that about them.
They might be a genius. So therefore, you got to sit tight for a while.
Right, the sitting tight. So that to me is a movie that absolutely plays into what a lot of these movies, and definitely any movie about Picasso, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
We see him just being
womanizing.
Yes,
yeah.
And doing it
the
to
muse.
Yeah, and the muse. The idea of the muse, which is so problematic when you really dig down into it, because the muse is never really like. Given proper
it can't be
credence.
It can't be an equal. It has to be this sort of like ephemeral, beautiful thing that is the subject of somehow of the work.
Well, this vessel for this the vessel, artist's artistic channeling, you know.
Yeah, like, I think there's also something in there, and this is actually in Mr. Turner, I have to say. There's an idea that the artist has to make a choice between family and the work, and commitment to relationships have to go by the wayside because the work is the thing, and we're supposed to feel grateful for that because that means that history has given us the Turners and the Picassos, and so the women in their lives made the necessary sacrifice so that we could have their work. It could be handed down to us. And I actually think as an audience, that's gratifying for us because we also want to have the great figure in front of us on the screen. Like there's a desire for the audience to sort of have access to that moment, you know, of greatness, so to speak.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like, where are the movies about failures? Like, I want to see a movie about a failure.
About artistic failure.
Artistic
Did you
failure.
See The Square, that Swedish movie?
No.
I forget
the name of the director, but
he's so good.
The movie's 30 minutes too long, and the narrative goes off the rails at the end. But it has these moments that are just absolutely spectacular in terms of sort of capturing the absurdity of the art world and some of the machinations that go into it, and that sometimes people who do become the big genius artists become that because there's this whole architecture that goes into making them that, it's dealers or museum directors or publicists, journalists, you know, the media who celebrate their work. And so then it just has some great scenes. If there's a scene, the movie is worth it for a scene in which this performance artist just goes literally apeshit. At a gala, like he's doing this monkey figure, and he starts like clowning around with all the patrons, and then he starts to get like violent, and nobody's sure whether he's like truly flipped out or if he's still in the performance. But the best part is because it's a performance, nobody really does anything.
Oh, right.
Oh, amazing.
That is amazing.
You saw At Eternity's Gate, right?
I did.
Okay, so that is the movie that is directed by Julian Schnabel, who, you know, interestingly enough to our topic, is a painter turned director. And he has
a better director than painter. But
yeah, I would say
and he has Willem Dafoe playing the titular character.
Yes. It's interesting. I think going back and watching Basquiat over this weekend, it's definitely a much better movie than Basquiat. His weakness, Dafoe is amazing. I think he's flawless as Van Gogh. He's such a good actor. And he does really interesting things with the cinematography in terms of creating this like kind of fractured cinematography when it's almost like this double vision. And I went to see the screening at LACMA, and afterwards Schnabel was talking about it. And he said, you know, I didn't just want to make a movie about Van Gogh. I wanted to make a movie about what it felt like to be Van Gogh. So these moments of like disorientation and intensity, and you don't quite know what's happening, and sort of trying to convey the sense of what may have been this visual sense of what may have been happening in his mind, that I think is really interesting. you know, like all things Julian Schnabel, it has its like overdone moments.
Yeah,
you know, there's
he is
like
a maximalist.
Yeah,
in ways.
And it's like he's gonna pound the message home. Like you're like, okay, I get it. Like he died poor to a bullet wound in his stomach, and only like one or two people ever bought a painting over his entire life. Like we all know that story.
Right. Like, you tell me something I don't know about
exactly.
Van Gogh at this
but
point.
It's like in the scene at the end, you know, it's like they're at Van Gogh's funeral, and people are literally like collectors are coming in and literally buying paintings off of his coffin.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm just like, and I'm like,
price to move.
Yeah, exactly.
Must sell.
Exactly. And it just, it was so ridiculous that, yeah. Yes, we know that Van Gogh was somebody who didn't get any traction until after he had died. But this was so literal, it almost made me laugh out loud.
Okay, so let's get into some of the tacky, the corny, the kind of depictions that make us cringe. I'm going to just first talk about one of the many depictions of Andy Warhol. This is maybe the first one I think I encountered, and it's from Oliver Stone's The Doors, where Val Kilmer is playing Jim Morrison. And obviously, it's not even really about Andy Warhol, but he makes a cameo. He's played by Crispin Glover, and he's played in the most creepy way.
Somebody gave me this telephone. I think it was Edie, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Edie.
Yeah. And she said that, I could talk to God with it, but I don't have anything to say. Here, this is for you. No, you can talk to God.
One of the things that you can't see, obviously, because this is a podcast, is that Crispin Glover is licking his lips way too often for anyone's comfort while he's talking to Jim Morrison. This is one of these portrayals that I find so bad that it's good. You know, it like crosses into some sort of territory that I just find like ridiculous and...
But I do think it's interesting that you can have such a range, so many versions of Andy Warhol on film. Like, this is someone that was, you know, everyone knew what he sounded like, what he looked like. He was very, you know, he was like in the middle of culture all the time. And yet he's in Basquiat. He's like a kind of avuncular, concerned friend, mentor for Basquiat. But in The Doors, he's like this weird, like
creepy,
ghoulish vampire, like lip-sucking vampire who has this quasi-mystical phone that talks to God.
Which is, I'm sure both interpretations are kind of true.
I mean,
true.
I suppose that's,
in terms of
like,
who
that's
Andy
him.
Warhol
like,
was.
You just, you project whatever you want.
Yeah, I feel like Andy Warhol would even appreciate that, maybe. Like, if he could just see all the depictions of Andy Warhol, he would, like, find that interesting.
And I think that is kind of, that is very Andy. Like, mm-hmm. That's what he was to culture, in a way. He wanted to, like, pour himself out of him, mm-hmm. out of his persona enough that anyone could be, like,
well, and it's always so much about, like, you know, his team, his milieu, the people around him, mm-hmm. who are sort of doing things for him or who are in his films, like his like squad, right?
Squad.
I mean, and he is this sort of emptied out figure who can then be portrayed by a lot of different people, but who also at the same time possesses this tremendous amount of capital because he's Andy Warhol.
He's like instantly recognizable.
That is what the work was about in a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah. Like, he was a brand, but one that, you know, was rather oblique.
In the vein of Crispin Glover, what are some other, like, tacky representation of artists that you can think of?
Do you mean, like biopic?
Yeah, biopics. I mean, should we bring up Frida, for instance? I have a soft spot for it.
I can't help it. You know...
Selma.
It is,
yeah, exactly.
And directed by Julie Taymor. Mm-hmm. I think the film, it's a cartoon. Mm-hmm. And again, going back to that idea of like, oh, I'm doing a movie about an artist, so I must therefore turn each scene into their art, I think is extraordinarily cheesy. And yep. I also think it's, you know, it plays Frida as this First of all, I think Selma Hayek is just too pretty to play Frida. Yeah, like, I mean, Frida just had a hardness to
that's
her.
That's true. Like a flintiness.
There's like a flintiness to her that I think
Blue Steel.
That Selma Hayek does just can't capture because she's like too soft and too beautiful. Mm-hmm. There was an actress who played her in a 1983 Mexican film called Frida Naturaleza Viva, Still Life. And she, Ofelia Medina, who played her, had this kind of like harder edge to her. And the film was a little bit more abstract. It was more of these like scenes in the life and non-linear narrative. And I think made sort of did much more justice to the artist than Frida, that often is always the story of Frida is always told in relation to Diego Rivera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so
that's
I think that's. There's a million stories you could tell about Frida, and I think any story about her would benefit from being shortened and perhaps focusing on a very specific window on her life. But I felt that movie, it hit all the big Frida gift shop tropes, and I'm gonna at the end of the film, I'm gonna walk out and get myself a postcard and a T-shirt,
totally.
But it didn't. I didn't necessarily feel. That it revealed something about who she was. And I think that's part of the tragedy with that painter, because she did do the stuff that was really important in terms of, you know, painting these very personal things about her body, which was not something that was done, taking like an everyday art form like the retablo and turning it into high art and using it to depict her miscarriages, like this religious art form to talk about her body.
That's revolutionary.
It's super revolutionary, but I think it gets lost in all the myth-making and the Diego and the bus accident and
absolutely.
I was not a fan of that film whatsoever. It's terrible.
Well, what about
I'm
just gonna lay that out. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, what about the more recent Antonio Banderas playing Picasso?
Oh, wonderful.
Picasso. Can I just say Picasso. It's
Picasso.
Like a superhero vocal fry is what I call that.
Picasso.
So Antonio Banderas, I mean, he picked up a Golden Globe nomination for this, and I'm a little bit, I mean, granted, we only suffered through one episode, but I'm a little bit like, why? Him and Salma Hayek are very similar in the fact that they're both like imminently beautiful and likable. You know what I mean? You see them on screen and you kind of just warm up to them right away. But his depiction of Picasso, so, I mean, the whole program to me suffers from a real kind of bloated sense of who Picasso was. We're supposed to find certain things about his life funny that I don't find funny, like when we see him painting Guernica and his wife and lover Dora Maar get into a physical match, fist fight, and he's like, ha ha, and then starts painting out of joy of his women brutalizing each other. I mean, that's just like not funny or cool to me. There's nothing like larkish about it.
Well,
that's how they
wanted
to treat it.
Somehow, like, in the first episode arc, which is also the only episode I've seen, and I do not intend to watch any more of it, like, we see him somehow, I mean, because there's all the sort of temporal switching, you know, around between historical periods, we see him somehow having, like, no political consciousness whatsoever, and then all of a sudden it's like the fascists come to take his art away, and he's just like, you know, this is about you or whatever. And it's like, you know, like, because, you know, who did this? You did this, you know, like, it's like, wow, really? Like, he somehow just like became so political. Like, I'm sorry. It's like you can't recuperate like all the self-absorption that you just spent like 30 minutes developing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you actually asked a good question, Margaret, when we watched it. Like, who is this for?
Yeah,
like
I
there's
know.
Nothing new. I feel like there's nothing to be wrung out of the Picasso story.
Surviving
at this point.
Picasso already hit. I mean, it was not good, but it already hit all of those. You know, I mean, it
that's
was
the James Merchant,
Merchant Ivory film. Yeah, which
covers the affair with Francoise Gillot, right?
Yes, and
Gillot.
Oh my God, I was like. It was so funny because I read Roger Ebert's review of that film today, and he's like, you know, Picasso wasn't necessarily a sexist, but he did highly value women as replaceable objects. And then he goes on to say, like,
it's like, I'm not a racist, but.
Yeah, I know. I love Ebert, but that's a real Ebert fail.
And he goes
right
on to say that the film was too much about Francois.
Francoise,
that you know, that it shouldn't have been filtered so much through her perspective. It should have been more about like the genius of the man. And it's like, wow, if that, you know, failed at doing that for, I mean, the bar is quite low, you know?
Yeah. That just is like the whole thing sailed over his head, which is weird because I feel like he usually had a pretty good sensitivity towards
At least surviving Picasso was called surviving Picasso versus genius Picasso.
Right.
Exactly. That for me was surviving genius Picasso.
Surviving genius.
My favorite scene out of Genius Picasso is when he's going to paint Guernica. The bombing of Guernica has happened.
Yes.
And he turns to someone and says,
I am going to need a very big canvas.
And I was like,
we're all supposed to be like, bah, bah, bah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my God, it's like Jaws. I need a bigger boat. You know? It's just like I just busted out laughing at that point. I was like, I can't take. Plus, you know, Antonio Banderas does look a little like Willem de Kooning.
One of the clips I want to play, because we need to get this in here, is probably my favorite, like, pretentious artist depiction, because that's another way that we see artists played out in films and TV, is they're shorthand for being just like insufferable, pretentious people that are almost like speaking a different language than the rest of us. And we can have a good hoot and laugh about it when it is in something like Big Lebowski and it's Julianne Moore playing an artist.
Does the female form make you uncomfortable, Mr. Lebowski?
Is that what this is a picture of?
In a sense, yes. My art has been commended as being strongly vaginal, which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable. Vagina.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, they don't like hearing it and find it difficult to say, whereas without batting an eye, a man will refer to his dick, or his rod, or his Johnson.
Johnson?
Oh, I love her so much. Oh my God. If you haven't watched that part of the movie in a long time, just dial back into it. It's worth it.
Genius Julianne Moore.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I'll watch that, Susan. You've been listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back with jams.
How does this sound? A weekend on a beautiful mountaintop in California. You wake up, eat a tasty meal with some new friends, some old friends, maybe the hosts of your favorite podcasts. After that, it's a couple of inspiring classes, spectacular podcast tapings, a hilarious stand-up showcase, a dance party, and more. And s'mores! All of this can be yours at Max FunCon, returning to Lake Arrowhead next June. Tickets go on sale Friday, November 23rd. Put that on your calendar because Max FunCon tickets always sell out. Get a head start planning your next summer vacation and go to maxfuncon.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler. With me in the studio are...
David Earl.
Sarah Kessler.
Carolina Miranda.
Every week on Pop Rocket, I think you guys have heard this question once or twice before. We always ask, what is your current jam? Sarah, can I get a delicious jam from you, please?
Oh, yes, you can. So my jam is Laura Branigan's Gloria from 1982. I've always really loved this song. It's one of my generation's karaoke favorites, and I've had it in my head for the last few days. So I've always been curious because it's like about this woman, Gloria, and like, what's Gloria's deal, right? Are the voices in your head calling Gloria, right? Like, and so as it turns out, the song is a cover of a 1979 Italian love song by Umberto Tozzi about an imaginary woman named Gloria who exists only in the mind of the singer. And when Branigan was first asked, tasked with covering the song, she had this, and her team had the idea of re-recording it as Mario, where a man was the imaginary figure that was being sung about. But that didn't work, so they changed it into a kind of portrait of this troubled woman named Gloria.
Yes.
Yeah. Taking
wow.
me back.
Imaginary woman, Italian love song. I didn't know any of this.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. David, what is your jam, please?
I went back into my Spotify-generated most listened to 2018.
Yeah, quality list, as we already covered.
Quality list. And I found Saba's log out.
Oh man, that is so good. It's so like mathematically satisfying, like the timing of it. Now yeah. He hits it.
But there's also like underneath, there's like a little bit of like kind of breathing room with the instrumentation. So it has both.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to listen to that on the way home. Carolina.
I'm going 90s.
Sweet.
Since we were talking about Mike Kelly. Yeah. I did a story recently on the artist Guadalupe Rosales, who did a whole project. It was an Instagram art project. It started on Instagram where she was archiving photos of Chicano youth from the 90s, like rave scene, party crews, everything Chicano youth related, especially related to these kind of self-constructed social scenes she was documenting. And in connection with that, she made a Spotify playlist. And the song by the Bucketheads called The Bomb, These Sounds Fall Into My Mind, is the first tune on the playlist. And I mean, the playlist just features these amazing mixes by like all these 90s, big 90s DJs like Little Louie Vega, Frankie Knuckles, Danny Tenaglia.
Oh my God, those are some names that I've not heard in a long time.
My 20s at the Sound Factory Bar in New York until 5 a.m. And so this, I just feel like when I need some pumping up, I put on this playlist. The name of the playlist is called Latinos in the House, a Matt Points mixtape. And this is the first song that comes on, and it just makes me so excited to hear it again. It's like hearing an old friend.
That has got some movement and energy to it.
I know. That'll make you forget Trump for a few minutes.
Yeah, just a few, but I'll take it. Oh, my God. I love it. I have a jam from a local musician who goes by the name Katsu Oso, but his real name is Paul Hernandez, and he's just a young fellow out of the San Gabriel Valley, which is like, what? What am I even saying? The San Gabriel Valley, like that's the hotbed of music. Not exactly, but I like that this guy is from there. Hometown pride and all that. This is called Crazy for Loving You.
Crazy for loving you.
Yeah. You didn't expect that, right?
But I think about you all the time. And well, it's hard to get you off my mind.
Yeah, you see that he's got a bit of a sense of humor. That's off of his record called Pastel. It's all that he's got out right now, but from what I've heard, it's a nice little slice of like 80s synthy bedroom romantic kind of pop, and I'm feeling it for this week. Before we say goodbye, I have one bonus jam to share. It's Macy Gray talking about Kanye's song Lost in the World off his album My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. Let's take a listen.
Oh, Lost in the World. I played that. I drove to Vegas and I played it almost the whole way there. Lost in the World. But now. Oh, that song is just amazing. It has like this, like vocally, there's this kind of choir build. Like it starts out small and then. Like, if you're just listening to it, it sounds like one big choir. But if you know vocals, you can hear the different melodies coming in as the song grows. And then his verse on that is bananas.
Macy Gray sounds adorable. Mm-hmm. So that was Macy Gray talking to our friends Oliver Wong, hello, and Morgan Rhodes of Heat Rocks. You can hear their entire interview on this week's Heat Rocks, which should already be available to listen to by the time you hear this. So check it out. They do a deep dive with Gray about that album. And if you're curious whether Macy had some thoughts about Kanye's MAGA hat, you don't want to miss this interview. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Margaret Wappler, with David Earle, Sarah Kessler, and Carolina Miranda. Where can we find more information about you, Miss Carolina Miranda?
Twitter, from which I never log off.
Yeah.
My handle is cmonsta, cmonstah.
Nice. Mr. David Earle.
DavidPEarle.com, and it's Earle, E-A-R-L-E, D-A-V-I-D-P-E-A-R-L-E.com.
Yeah, did you hear that spelling, everyone?
Because
often be mistaken for having no E on the end. Sarah Kessler, where can we find more about you?
You can also find me on Twitter, at Movable Jaw.
What is that a reference to, by the way?
It's a reference to a ventriloquist dummy's jaw, or just a person's jaw.
Okay.
Moves.
Nice.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was like from a very specific work.
No, it's not, but I think it's a pretty good handle. So
yeah, I'm feeling it. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. However, we don't have many reviews this week, and that's a real problem because you can see that our very own Karen Tongson has fallen ill. It used to be me that we worried about alone, but really, we need the health. We need the 5-star reviews for the entire family, so get on it. This is ridiculous, people. If you want us to hear your feedback or even ask a panelist for advice, I don't know why you would want to do that, but you can call 530-237-4108. That is our hotline, 530-237-4108. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group, or find us on Instagram at Pop Rocket Podcast and join the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by Shayna Deloria. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.